You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. is reopening. Life is getting back to normal-ish. But millions of Americans with weakened immune systems are still at a high risk of contracting a severe case of COVID-19. An immunologist joins the show to tell us more. Now, the Biden administration says it's standing by Dr. Anthony Fauci after last week's release of thousands of his emails during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. The bulk of the messages were obtained by BuzzFeed through open records requests. The Washington Post acquired a few hundred as well. The emails detail his communications with senior U.S. officials, overseas counterparts, and everyday Americans. They cover the debate over mask wearing, the origins of the virus, whether the Trump administration was censoring him, and more. Some of his comments line up with things he's said publicly. In some other cases, there's not a perfect match. On Friday, President Biden told reporters he's, quote, very confident in Fauci. And even though White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki didn't comment on the email specifically, she said his job is safe.
Can you imagine any circumstance where President Biden would ever fire him?
No.
Some congressional Republicans say the emails prove it's time for Fauci to go. We want to know what you think of Dr. Anthony Fauci at 800-642-1234. Do you think he did a good job advising the country through the pandemic? Do you have less confidence in him? What questions do you have about his role as a chief medical advisor now to the White House? And do you have thoughts or questions about these emails? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Natalie Bettendorf is a contributing writer to BuzzFeed. She combed through the Fauci emails. Natalie, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back, Rob.
Natalie, I want to start with the pursuit of these emails. What kind of things were you asking for in your request?
Yeah, so for those who aren't familiar with how a FOIA request works, and that's the Freedom of Information Act, Jason, my co-reporter on this story, recently went through a lot of the emails that we've been getting in from this batch, but it started way back in March of 2020, right when the WHO was declaring COVID-19 a global pandemic. Now, the way that this works is you have to be very specific in asking for these emails and asking for any kind of government agency documents. So Jason actually filed multiple requests for these emails. And we asked for all emails, texts sent and received by Dr. Fauci mentioning or referring to COVID-19, coronavirus, and any and all internal studies on COVID. So that was the number one thing we had to do, is be really specific to the National Institute of Health to say, this is what we're looking for. And really, these over 3,200 pages of emails have trickled in over, you know, months and over a year now. So that's been a long ongoing story and investigation for us.
And you've had a lot of reading material in this time, Natalie. What were some of the biggest things that stuck out to you as you were going through them?
Yeah, I think the thing that Jason and I were trying to focus on the most was really looking at Dr. Fauci's tone. We had the privilege of reading these emails, a very behind the scenes look at who is this man and who had all this pressure on him right from the beginning of 2020, of this pandemic that really took over the world. And we were seeing it unfold in real time while reading these emails. You know, we could see the timestamps, we could see who he was communicating with and who he was ignoring. You know, that was so important for us to really look at, you know, who is Dr. Fauci and what are we not seeing beyond these press conferences that he's doing? One email that really stood out to me, I think, is when he was communicating with an ABC News reporter, and this was earlier on in 2020, and this reporter was very curious about what Dr. Fauci thought the death toll would be from COVID-19 and proposed the number of 500,000. And Dr. Fauci replied and said he thought that number was way too high. And here we are, you know, in June of 2021, and we are seeing a number that is far beyond 500,000 deaths. And it is devastating, but it really shows, you know, it's Dr. Fauci's a human, and he didn't know how much of a impact this virus would have.
Now, Phil, what was your reaction to what you've seen in these messages, this window into a key player in the earliest stages of these emails of the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, in reading these emails, and I think people should read them, it's really great reporting, and it's a really important, I think, historical archive for the pandemic. You see what a sort of unenviable position a civil servant like Tony Fauci is in, with pressure to sort of underplay the severity and significance of the pandemic coming politically, but also real awareness in the public health community about its severity. And, you know, you see a civil servant in a position like that has sort of three options. They can sort of resign or, you know, get out of town. They can essentially accede to what the administration wants them to do, or they can exercise voice and actually be a person who's speaking truth to power. The third option here is really the most difficult. And you see in these emails the way that Fauci sort of finessed this, in part by building coalitions, I think, within the administration, outside of the administration, of developing a reputation for speaking clearly, plainly, respectfully in a moment where that kind of language and conversation isn't that common. And so, I mean, it's a really quite a delicate balancing act that somebody like that has to perform. And I think it's emblematic of the tense relationship that career civil servants had with the Trump administration really for 4 years.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University and Natalie Bettendorf with BuzzFeed, looking at Dr. Anthony Fauci's emails, large releases, many of them from a request from BuzzFeed, and what they tell us about the early response to COVID-19. You can join in with your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has been one of Dr. Fauci's biggest critics all along, calling for him to be fired now after the release of these emails, in particular over Fauci and the issue of the origins of the virus. Here's Senator Rand Paul on Fox News last week.
And as you know, gain of function is where you take an animal virus and you make it into a super virus that infects humans. They were doing this at the Wuhan lab. Dr. Fauci still denies it to this day. But in his private emails, he puts in the subject line, urgent, we must discuss this gain of function research. So he knows it's gain of function and he needs to be pinned down on this.
Natalie, can you tell us more about some of the response we've seen from some congressional Republicans and how it matches up with what's actually in the emails we've seen?
Yeah, so something that Jason and I made sure to focus on when we were reading through these emails is that we can't really interpret or, you know, make assumptions about what was going on in Fauci's mind, what were his certain motives or intentions, if he had any, right, while he was sending these emails. It's really important from a journalistic perspective to read these emails for what they are. What is the actual content? And, you know, there has been communication in some of these emails about, you know, this, you know, theory of where the virus came from. Did it come from a lab? And that's something that's been on all of our minds. But personally, as someone who has read through the majority of these emails and split it with Jason, you know, that is not a conclusion that we could come to. And that's why we didn't state it in our article. These are things that were happening in the discussions, right, in a lot of the emails, but there was nothing conclusive, right, from what we could read. And so I think what's important is to really be very realistic about the actual content of these emails rather than reading between the lines or making guesses as to what this could have said. So I think coming from a reporting perspective, our main goal is to make sure these are accurate and these are verifiable and then put them out in the world for the public to do with what they will, because this is public information from a government agency.
And Phil, your thoughts on the politics of the origin of the virus? And again, it should be very clear, we don't know the origin of the virus. The direct from animals possibility is still out there. There's more openness to the idea of investigating a possible lab leak, though no direct evidence of that either. But it's become a big political issue, Phil. What do you make of it?
Right. I think it's really, really important to note that the evidence that you would need to point in one direction or the other is capacious. And there are many gaps in that story about the lab leak hypothesis that I think will be a very long time before we figure out. Of course, the reason that this matters is not merely getting to the bottom of the scientific controversy, This is being grafted onto a broader political controversy because COVID sort of from the beginning was entangled both in domestic political disputes about what government should have done, the sort of directing attention to the sort of origins of the virus helps to sort of defray or distract attention from sort of the domestic challenges of like, okay, a pandemic came to our shores, you know, what was our response and was it appropriate, sort of distracts attention from that. But I think it's also grafted onto this larger geopolitical conflict between the United States and China. And I think it's worth trying to separate those two things, because right now in this discussion over this lab leak hypothesis, they're very entwined. And so being able to set that aside and separate it is a very, very difficult task. But we have to realize those two things as they're currently being discussed are heavily entwined with one another in the way that they're being brought up.
We're talking about Dr. Anthony Fauci, what we're learning from some of his emails recently obtained by media outlets from the early days of the pandemic. Natalie Bettendorf has been reading many of those emails, contributing writer at BuzzFeed. Phil Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, also with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions for our guests, or email ideas at WPR.org. Conversation continues, and we'll hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking a look at Dr. Anthony Fauci's emails from the early days of the pandemic. BuzzFeed News and other outlets obtained thousands of messages through Freedom of Information Act requests. Natalie Bettendorf was part of one of those efforts. She's a contributing writer at BuzzFeed and studied these emails. Phil Rocco, also with us, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, author of Obamacare Wars. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess my biggest anger with Dr. Fauci is due to his duplicity that these emails show. There were a lot of people who were telling us the correct information that through the media were totally denigrated and made to look like fools. And I think of people like the anesthesiologist who was an advisor to Stanford anesthesiologist that was an advisor to Trump, who was telling that the correct information throughout, yet the media totally lambasted him and even got him to be censured by his own medical school. I guess I find so many people who
which information, Charlie, in particular?
About the lockdown, about masks, about all the stuff. It became a political football rather than a real search for truth. And there were people's businesses that were ruined because people were following, quote unquote, the science that actually wasn't scientific. And I guess there was a lot of duplicity because of the politics involved, as opposed to really saying this is what we know and this is a correct way to go forward. Anyone who Facebook would take off anybody who said that the Wuhan lab could have leaked the virus. They said this is a conspiracy. They had 27, 28 virologists, famous virologists, say that this wasn't true. And yet now we're going, oh, wait, this might be true.
Charlie, you know, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Phil, duplicity from Dr. Fauci, Charlie is saying.
Well, I think one of the challenges in dealing with a novel viral event is, especially at the outset, there's a lot of confusion. You can see that in the emails because the science is still kind of coming in as the pandemic is happening. I mean, I would say, however, that on the issue, for example, of masks or social distancing, I mean, the evidence has pretty clearly borne out, and, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. You can go and actually look at the sort of meta-analyses of numerous studies that have been conducted to show the effectiveness of those non-pharmaceutical interventions, which, if you think back to the beginning of the pandemic, with thousands of people dying every day, those were the tools that we had. And so while I think that there's certainly a lot of confusion and that confusion can breed political conflict and kind of political predation on the scientific controversy, you know, I would emphasize that, you know, at least on the question of those non-pharmaceutical interventions, I think in the end, those will have been shown to be highly effective.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. We'll go to Pat now in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a son and a daughter-in-law that are in the medical field, and they thought Dr. Fauci was spot on all the time. He was operating under a handicap when you had the leader of the free world telling people they should probably drink Lysol. And also, as far as Rand Paul is concerned, what is Rand Paul? He wants to argue with Dr. Fauci all the time, and Dr. Fauci wins the arguments, and Rand Paul just gets a little bit madder. So anyway, my whole thrust on this is Fauci did a heck of a job at a very, very difficult time. And so if you had a couple of emails throughout this period that don't jive, who the hell cares, right?
Thanks for the call. Natalie, a lot of people were emailing Dr. Fauci to offer encouragement, as I think Pat was there, and even ask him ask him questions about the COVID-19 virus, even just members of the public. What kind of things did we see there?
Yeah, I think the most notable thing for me when reading through these emails were emails from people who were not health officials or people who were in positions of power. They were regular people who were very freaked out and very concerned about this virus, and especially in the onset of the pandemic, like we've talked about in early 2020. I mean, these emails range from January of 2020 to June of 2020, so those first 6 months of last year. And so, you know, Dr. Fauci was fielding these emails and actually responding on his personal volition to many people who had basic questions about, you know, was it safe to fly domestically, right? Or people who had asked him, like, I have this certain vaccine. If I get a vaccine for this type of pneumonia, will this protect me? Will this protect my loved ones? And Fauci was very personable in his responses and actually giving medical advice and really advising people who were very scared, because he understood that in his position, he could be someone who people turned to when they needed some advice or were unable to answer these questions from their own doctors or medical experts. So I found that fascinating.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on Troy in Muskego now. Troy, hello.
Oh, I just wanted to say that. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say that the last person that called in hit it spot on. I mean, you can tell by the caller that was even before him. Like, a lot of this is just conspiracy. And let's just look at facts, because I haven't, you know, the last caller pointed out facts. The facts are we had a president that lied. And because he lied, he had a doctor under him that we don't know what's going on. He could have been threatening the guy's family. You know what I mean? We don't know what kind of threats that Trump and his administration was making to Dr. Fauci. All I know is I was grateful to God that Fauci was not associated with Trump, and he was kind of like, he had to kind of walk that line, and we had somebody in there that would, you know, keep us going through this pandemic and shoot it to us straight. This is just conspiracy theory. You got people that support Trump that don't even believe, they believe the election was rigged. That's why they're pushing this theory.
I got you. Troy, I think we take your point. Just don't have too much time left. I want to get our guests in on this. Natalie, one thing that stood out in a lot of the emails was Anthony Fauci saying he wasn't being muzzled or censored, for the most part anyway, by the Trump administration. What kind of things did we see there?
Right. Yeah, that was a very interesting email that we came across, where people actually expressed to Dr. Fauci that they were scared for him, asking if he was being harassed by the Trump administration. And, you know, he was very stable and very secure in his point that he was making sure that politics did not meddle with his work as a physician, as a medical advisor. And so when people did express their concern, you know, he was making sure to communicate that he is not there to get in the mix of politics and to engage in that kind of discourse, which we saw a lot at the beginning and throughout 2020 with the Trump administration. So that part of it is something that a lot of people have expressed and a lot of the responses people have said, which is that Fauci really was very focused, right? He's very, very focused on his job here, and he made sure to kind of quell any of that discourse surrounding the political pressure.
Thanks for that call. Phil, it all makes me think of something you said earlier on, the historical interest of these emails, these early reactions when a lot of the science was uncertain about how this disease spread, the silent spread we didn't know about for the early period of these emails. What kind of lessons do you think we can take from what we're learning here for hopefully a long time in the future, the next pandemic?
I think the largest lesson is that we should take, and I can't pretend to speak with any authority on it, but it is something that we should try to find in the emails, is how do you balance a kind of humility about what we can and can't know, which, you know, you can definitely see Fauci doing. I mean, there's, you know, it's important to recognize what knowledge you don't have, and he certainly appears to do so. But how do you balance that with communicating to the public in a clear way based on the best of your knowledge about what is safest, while preserving your ability to be wrong, to revise yourself, and to learn from mistakes? That is a very delicate series of tasks. It's something that is kind of, I think, awe-inspiring to a certain extent about the way that civil servants have to respond to. And it's something that we should try to learn from and study.
And in our just last few minutes, Natalie, I assume one Freedom of Information Act request leads to another. Do you have more emails you're waiting to see or other documents you're in search of?
Yes, this is ongoing. The way that FOIA works is that they take a very long time to get you all the documents. So actually, in addition to having more documents coming in from this period and more recent months after June of 2020, we still probably will get more emails from that time period as well. So lots of more documents coming in. So this is an ongoing investigation.
Natalie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
And Phil, thanks for being with us again.
Great to be here.
Natalie Bettendorf is a contributor to BuzzFeed. She combed through thousands of emails from Dr. Anthony Fauci from the earlier days of the pandemic, obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. And Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Coming up, millions of Americans have compromised immune systems, and some of them may not gain protection from the COVID vaccines. An expert explains who's at risk and how to protect them as the pandemic continues. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, steel prices are going up. That's good news for American steel producers, but less so for manufacturers who buy steel. We'll find out what's happening and how long the price uptick is expected to last. Now, as the world is reopening, there are millions of Americans whose immune systems are compromised. People who have had radiation treatment or chemotherapy, people with chronic kidney disease, transplant recipients, people take certain medications, and people who are born with immune system problems all are among people whose bodies may not respond as effectively to the vaccines. For people with weakened immune systems, getting COVID can carry a higher risk of severe illness or death. Dr. Christine Cerugi is a professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health's Department of Pediatrics. She's also director of the Pediatric Immune Deficiency Clinic at the American Family Children's Hospital and an expert in immunology. Dr. Cerugi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I gave a few of the conditions that might lead to somebody being considered immunocompromised. Can you tell us a little bit more about who we're particularly worried about, even in the COVID vaccine era?
Yes. As you mentioned, there are millions of Americans that are immunocompromised. The patients that I take care of have what we call inborn errors of immunity, and these are children that are born without working immune systems. But it is much broader than that. You listed a few of the conditions. And immune-compromised patients are in all of our communities. These are patients that currently are being treated for cancer, cancer survivors, patients with autoimmune conditions or other conditions that need to take medications that suppress their immune system on a daily basis.
What does this mean when somebody gets a vaccine and they're immunocompromised? I assume there's kind of a range of possible outcomes, but what is the risk that the vaccine isn't going to work at all or is going to be much less effective?
Yeah, excellent question. And as you might expect, we don't have all the information we would like right now at this time with respect to the COVID-19 vaccine. But we have a lot of information with respect to other vaccinations. And so emerging data suggests that the COVID-19 vaccine is safe for our patient populations, but how it works is likely to be diminished. And so the goal of the vaccine is to develop antibodies against COVID-19. And so individuals that don't have a working immune system aren't going to be able to develop antibodies to the same level as somebody that's not taking immunosuppressive therapy. We do know from a few emerging studies looking at patients with cancer as well as on immunosuppressive therapy that the vaccine response for the COVID vaccine is diminished. And that's in line with what other studies have shown with the influenza vaccine.
If someone's out there listening and saying, yeah, that's me, one of those categories of people who are immunocompromised, they're thinking, that's me, I haven't gotten the vaccine yet. Is it worth it for me to get the vaccine, given that it might not be as effective? What are the current recommendations?
Yes. And so the current recommendation, of course, I would advise anybody to speak with their personal physician. But the general recommendation for immune-compromised individuals is get vaccinated. The vaccine is safe. This is not a live vaccine. It's a safe vaccine. And we have reason to believe, based on an individual situation, that there may be a response. Even if you don't make antibodies, there are other parts of the immune system that the vaccine may be activating that would give you protections against the infection, or at least diminish the severity of the infection.
Then I wonder about kind of the COVID hygiene. A lot of us are in places now without masks, doing stuff that we weren't doing for the last year. For the person who's immunocompromised, are they going to want to keep up some of those precautions that that a lot of us are letting go of now?
Yes. So getting back to the vaccination recommendation for immune-compromised individuals, I recommend get vaccinated, but behave as though you're not. And so this requires a continued risk assessment. With respect to hygiene, I recommend that patients that are immune-compromised to assess every situation. Know what's going on in your community with respect to the prevalence of active COVID diseases. Just continue to socially distance, wear masks, avoid crowded situations, and ideally only congregate indoors with without mask with individuals that you live with or small groups of people whom you know well and know their vaccination status.
Now, I wonder, I'm not immunocompromised. I am fully vaccinated as of last Friday. I'm happy to say it was my 2 week after the second dose date. Me making that decision, or anybody else not immunocompromised getting vaccinated, are they going to help break the chain of infection that could threaten those people who aren't getting that full benefit of the vaccination?
Absolutely, 100%. And so I recommend that everybody get vaccinated for themselves and for their communities. And so individuals that don't respond robustly to the COVID-19 rely on the goodness of others to be protected against the COVID-19 vaccine and other communicable diseases. And so individuals in that are not immune compromised getting vaccinated are helping themselves, and they're helping their whole community, including the immune compromised community.
Now, COVID, as I understand it, probably isn't going to go away. What kind of research is out there that you're maybe hopeful for treatment for people who catch COVID-19 despite their best efforts and maybe are immunocompromised? Is there anything on the horizon that could maybe help them?
Yes. And so there are some therapies that are being looked at. So in certain situations where a patient does not make antibodies, as I mentioned, there are pharmaceutical products available right now that are monoclonal antibodies that are specific for the COVID-19 virus. And so those biologics, that's what they're called, are being used for at-risk individuals that have become infected with COVID-19. That's not severe enough to land them in the hospital. But is given as an infusion to protect against getting severe disease. And so some of the ongoing studies are, can we use that product for individuals that we know are at risk? Could you give that on a regular basis as a preventative? And I'm hopeful that that might be a therapy that's available in the future for some of my patients.
Dr. Saruji, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Christine Saruji, professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health's Department of Pediatrics. She's also director of the Pediatric Immune Deficiency Clinic at the American Family Children's Hospital. She joined us for a look at people with compromised immune systems who may be at risk still of COVID-19, even with vaccines. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Today, WPR's Carl Christensen brings us a story about Wisconsin comedian Charlie Hill.
My name is Charlie Hill, Sagoli. I'm a Oneida. I'm from Wisconsin. It's part of your coronation. My people are from Wisconsin. We used to be from New York. We had a little real estate problem.
Charlie Hill grew up watching his favorite comics get laughs on late-night TV. WPR's Beta sat down with comedy historian Cliff Nesteroff, who talked about Charlie Hill's path to becoming an unsung hero of comedy and a symbol of hope for many indigenous peoples.
When Charlie Hill was a kid growing up in Oneida, he was obsessed with television. He would sort of sneak out of his bedroom at night and peek through the door, and he would see his mom watching The Tonight Show with Jack Parr. And one night he saw a comedian named Dick Gregory. He talked about the civil rights movement in his stand-up act. He was really the first comedian to do that. And eventually he would fuse comedy and activism. That was very inspiring to Charlie Hill.
After majoring in speech and comedy at UW-Madison, Charlie Hill headed to Los Angeles in 1972 and started hanging out at the Comedy Store. There, he was a contemporary of many soon-to-be stars, including Robin Williams and David Letterman. One night, Richard Pryor saw Hill perform, and he loved his act so much that he invited him to appear on his TV show, making Hill the first Native American comedian to ever perform comedy on television.
Columbus discovered America. They taught me that when I was a kid. Columbus discovered Indians, you know. That was my education. You see, like, black people, Indians were driven to all-white schools, you see. Except the black people got the buses. The Indians were just driven.
That night, 15 million people saw Hill's act, and his career took off from there, touring the country and eventually landing a spot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Nesteroff describes Charlie Hill's performance that night.
Charlie Hill had this triumphant set on The Tonight Show in 1978 because it was fresh and new to see a Native comedian coming at things from an indigenous angle. You know, it was embraced by this white audience because it was sort of a novelty. The irony is that today that would still be considered a novelty because there has never been another Native American comedian since then to appear on The Tonight Show.
The white men wrote the history books. Out of hell with you, Injun. We got the typewriters. First 20 minutes they were here, they were building houses, and we asked, excuse us, fellas, you gonna stay overnight, huh? Don't you just hate it when you have company over for dinner and they never leave?
Charlie Hill enjoyed a long and successful career in comedy and acting until his passing in 2013. Nesteroff talks about Hill's legacy in comedy, as well as his continued inspiration within indigenous communities.
There's well over 100 indigenous comic performers today, stand-ups, even in the industry, comedy writers and comedy producers. Essentially, all of them will say, yeah, Charlie Hill's the guy. I saw Charlie Hill on A&E's Evening at the Improv, or I saw him on the Arsenio Hall Show, and that was the moment that I decided I wanted to do comedy. He was so important to every indigenous performer, and more than that, he was just important to all indigenous communities in North America as this incredible representative who never sold himself out, who never engaged in stereotypes, was true to himself, was proud of himself, and was an inspiration to thousands and thousands and thousands of indigenous peoples.
I usually have problems doing my act, you know, because I know a lot of you white people never seen an Indian do stand-up comedy before, you know. Like, for so long, you probably thought that Indians never had a sense of humor, you know. We never thought you were too funny either.
Cliff Nesteroff is the author of We Had a Little Real Estate Problem, The Unheralded Story of Native Americans and Comedy. You can learn more about Charlie Hill in the full version of the Beta interview at wpr.org/beta. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, the price of steel is going up. Industry experts say it's thanks in part to Trump-era tariffs on steel and aluminum and partly because of increased demand as the economy bounces back. We'll find out what it means for the steel industry in the U.S. and manufacturers who buy steel here at Wisconsin Businesses. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Naomi Osaka's exit from the French Open has put a spotlight on sports and mental health. Naomi and the Power of No, that's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the price of American steel is reaching record highs. That's getting cheers from steel producers who have gone through years of layoffs and mill closures. But for some manufacturers who buy steel, a lot of whom are based here in Wisconsin, the uptick has meant big increases in the cost of doing business. Matt Phillips covers financial markets for the New York Times. He recently took a closer look at what's happening with steel. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, before this surge in prices, can you just give us a sense of the state of the steel industry in the United States?
Sure. I mean, steel had undergone a decades-long transition that was pretty painful for the upper Midwest. The employment levels in the industry fell 75% over a series of from the late 60s on. It really bottomed in terms of employment during the COVID crisis when steel levels of employment reached the lowest levels on record.
How big a jump now are we seeing in steel prices?
I mean, it's pretty remarkable. If you look at a chart, it's fairly vertical. I mean, the prices for Midwestern steel, which is the benchmark steel price in the country, was about $450 back in last August. It's now at about $1,650.
Wow.
So, it's about threefold higher. It's really something that's pretty unprecedented in the history of the industry.
Okay. Because why? What led to that huge increase?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different reasons why. I mean, the steel industry, like everyone else, was impacted by the COVID crisis, so they had to shut down production, and there was simultaneously a huge rebuild of demand as we've come back from most of the COVID crisis. So, it's really a question of surging demand now. The companies, the manufacturers and construction companies are coming back and they're finding their inventories are almost empty and they're finding that there's really long lead times to get steel in the door. So they are rushing to buy anything they can at any price they can. And at the same time, the producer, that's the demand side. You know, prices are a story of supply and demand. So there's a lot of demand, but the production is coming back, but sort of slowly. You know, there's been a lot of consolidation in that industry over the last couple of years. And when an industry is very consolidated, it allows the producers to sort of keep a tight rein on the increasing the supply. That keeps prices up. And that's kind of what you want if you're a producer of steel.
Now, how about foreign steel?
Foreign steel is basically still being tariffed, except for so the Trump steel tariffs, which were more extensive than tariffs that were put in place by either President Obama or President Bush, both of whom were involved in steel tariffs. They're still in place. They've been weakened somewhat. We have a trade deal with Mexico and Canada, which has allowed some of their steel to come back in. And there are one-off exemptions that the federal government has made to individual companies who were able to appeal tariffs on the imports that they need. But by and large, the tariffs are still in place, particularly on Europe and China, who are our main competitors. So, I mean, that keeps a ton of cheap supply out of this country and keeps prices higher.
Matt Phillips is with us. He covers financial markets in the New York Times, looking at a big jump in the price of steel. So, Matt, if I make steel or if I work for somebody who does high prices of steel, it's good news. If I want to make stuff out of steel, what are we seeing for manufacturers, including some in Wisconsin, with these higher costs of their raw material?
Yeah, not as good. It's not as good for them, for sure. There's definitely a tug of war going on here. I talked to a steel fabricator based in the Detroit area. You know, obviously there's a lot of automotive suppliers around in that area. They basically are being forced to absorb really high price increases. And despite the fact that the economy is coming back to life, this is putting a real financial strain on them. They're, you know, complaining that some of them are even talking about potential layoffs, even though the auto industry is expected to come back strong and there's huge demand for cars right now. It's hard to get a new car or a used car. So it's kind of a microcosm of the unique position the economy is in right now, where we've got these real pains of trying to restart the United States economy, which is this super tanker. You know, you cannot get it going without a lot of lead up to get things moving. So that's what I see the steel story as, kind of a microcosm of the broader economic story that the country faces right now.
All right. So with this steel kind of bottleneck and high prices, are steel manufacturers looking to really expand production, or are they thinking, yeah, this isn't going to last, I'm not going to open up new facilities or anything like that and then have too much supply?
Yeah, no, that's sort of the question. And basically the view of the steel manufacturers is you can't build a steel plant when prices are at record highs. You know, you're asking for trouble if you built it with the projection that you're going to keep getting steel prices at the record high of $1,650, then you're basically guaranteed to lose money. There are some new steel plants that are coming online that were planned a couple of years ago. And they credit, you know, the companies that are doing that credit the Trump tariffs to a certain extent as making them more willing to invest in those capacity expansions, because, you know, their prices would be higher if they don't have to worry about Chinese steel coming in and undercutting them. So really what the best you can expect is some of those pre-planned capacity additions to come online later this year, and also increased production at the plants and the productive capacity that we have, just basically running more shifts, running integrated steel mills faster so that they produce more. And over time, there is confidence that supplies will come back. But in the meantime, it's interesting. It's going to be an interesting period where we see these really strong price increases, and whether they start to hurt demand and whether that starts a weird mini cycle in the economy where people start to pull back from activity just because they can't deal with these steel prices.
And Matt, in our last minute or so, how much will consumers notice this, whether in higher costs for stuff or longer waits to get stuff?
I think they'll definitely notice it in terms of the wait time for different products. It's interesting, these supply chains of these companies are really extended, and a lot of the pain is kind of inflicted on the smaller suppliers along the way, so that the giant end manufacturer, the OEM automaker, has a lot of power with these suppliers. So it remains to be seen. I mean, a lot of the big companies that you would know, you know, the car makers, the farm equipment makers, they have said in their most recent public statements that they don't expect huge price increases for their products, and they expect to pass along some of this, but it won't hopefully be a sticker shock that makes demand for their products collapse. So it remains to be seen is the short answer, but at least some of the major corporations that sell these things directly to the end consumer are hinting that while there should be some increases, they don't want to startle people with a giant sticker shock situation.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thanks a million, Rob.
That's Matt Phillips. He's a reporter who covers financial markets at the New York Times. He joined us today to talk about steel prices, why they've gone up a lot, and how that impacts manufacturers, including those here in Wisconsin. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, it's a story of life and debt. Personal finance writer Lynette Calfani Cox joins the show with answers to your questions about credit and paying off debt. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then police officers receive training on when to use deadly force, but many departments don't put official rules about use of force on the books. We'll talk to a UW law professor about his research into what actually governs when police use force. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.